You know how it's done. First, you destroy the virtues, make them unclear. Then you destroy the history, tear down the statues and rewrite the history, like 1619. And then you cancel anyone who dares object, not just people like me, but people like you. If you tweet on something, if you like something, if you say something, they'll find you, they'll isolate you, they'll cancel you. We're going to be talking about this on the Chicago Way with our guest, Carol Markowitz. She's written a fine column on it for the New York Post. But first, this is John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And my co-host, as always, is Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokon Show. And when I tell you what happened to the last podcast, you won't believe it, because I didn't believe it either. This is the Chicago Way on WGN.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
So, Jeff Carlin?
Yes, John.
You offered, you know, the old dog ate my homework thing?
Yeah.
Well, this is a cat story, and you know I hate cats, and Jeff loves cats. I love Jeff and Christine, but I just can't abide their soul-sucking incubuses of Satan. And what happened was that we were late with getting up the last podcast. Ray Lopez, you know, calling Alderman Ray Lopez, calling Lori Lightfoot Bug Bunny and so forth, and the Bobby Rush's popcorn. And I kept asking Jeff, where's the podcast? Why isn't it up? Why isn't it up? You know, because he has to do all the work around here. And why don't you tell the listeners what you told me?
Yes. So this, what was this? We taped a podcast, because I'm going to set you back to the day when we taped the podcast. We taped it. It was went really well. I was very happy with all the audio, and we're editing it. And I think it was Wednesday, Thursday. By Thursday night into Friday, I was had an issue, which I didn't know about. Where I work at home, John and I do this via Zoom, and I have a great little studio set up. It's, you know, super low tech, but it works. And I've got a keyboard, and then I also, when we're doing this, I also have a laptop I used for that tracks everything, and I use to edit. And I left my laptop in my studio under the keyboard for my microphone setup for the PC laptop I have at home that kind of runs some of my other stuff. And I get home after a night out, John, which I actually went and did some outdoor dining, which was pretty cool, but that's not the story. I get home and to check on my computer, my laptop, and grab something to do a little bit of work. And it looks like there's a pool of water on my keyboard, which the keyboard was resting on top of the laptop. And what the hell? I'm looking at the ceiling. It hadn't rained. I had a bottle of water on my desk, but it was where I left it, and it just didn't seem right. Sure enough, I pick up the keyboard, and a ton of urine runs out of it. And boy cat urine.
Jesus!
But yeah, boy cat urine, which is distinctly known for being very stinky. And I pick up my laptop, and of course, more runs out of that. And so
it's all over the carpet.
Yeah, it's all over the desk. It's all over. I had some sound deadening material here for when I tape stuff. Got all over that.
Absorbent.
Yeah, absorbent. But it simultaneously, because it knocked out my keyboard, so I didn't have a keyboard for the next 24 hours at home. And then it also killed my laptop, which had the edited version of the podcast once done, which was ridiculous and heartbreaking.
So will you just reduce this to you're going all around in circles and you're not saying the truth, which is you called me and said,
yes.
John, I'm sorry. What did you say? I'm sorry. We're late because what?
Right. I forgot. I think I texted you first, didn't
yeah.
I?
Maybe. Right.
And then you called me and we pull. I want, for the record, I want to pull up the text.
Well, he's doing that. The point is that when he told me that, you know, I've it's not like he doesn't have anything to do. He's the executive producer of the Rokan show on WGN. So he's constantly dealing with guests and people dumping and trying to get other guests. And would you please come on at 6:40, at 6:45, 5:45, 5:15, whatever. The five at five, beat the chef, stump the chef segments, and dealing with Roe in his other ear. So he's got issues, but I do too. I'm writing four columns a week. Nobody in the country writes four columns a week the way I do it. I don't think anybody does. So there he goes, and he tells me that, oh, sorry, we're up. Now, I wanted that column up because I'm writing a column off it. I want that podcast. And then
the synergy. So apparently I didn't text you. I just called you. And when I called you, I said, John, my computer's dead. My cat killed it.
Yeah. And I said, that's the biggest effing lie. That's like my dog ate my homework.
Right.
I didn't believe him. I was pissed, but what was I going to do? Get in a fight with my friend, you know?
Right. Exactly. But,
I did not believe you until you sent me that photograph.
Yeah. So the photograph I sent John is that I took the laptop, buried it in rice. Thank God I had some of my coronavirus quarantine emergency rice on hand. I wrapped it in saran wrap and left it for a few days and then baked it in the oven at a low temperature for an hour, hoping that would revive it. But as the engineers at work at the station told me that urine is generally very acidic and is like napalm for computer parts. I'm like, oh, great. So needless to say, that computer is dead. And it took me the weekend then to re-edit the podcast and get it up.
How did you get it off the computer where you stored it?
So I run.
Here we get into the techno geeky.
We get a little geeky, but I run this. So when we do this stuff and track stuff, I run it off my desktop computer. And then I transfer it to my laptop to edit it so I can edit it at work or edit it on the fly and edit it wherever I am. The cat peed on the keyboard that was on the laptop. And so the desktop here was fried, and I couldn't get a laptop till Friday. And then that led me into the weekend, and Fridays are tough days to edit. Get to sit down and edit, and editing takes a couple hours. But, John, the comeuppance didn't stop there. Apparently, I somehow my spirit angered the cats because I've had more problems with the cats. Over the weekend, I got to see my parents again and hang out with them and do a bunch of work on their house. And I may have overdone it, climbing ladders and twisting and turning, and I'm grossly out of shape. But I got Monday morning, I was walking through our living room, and one of the cats flew out from underneath a chair, tripping me. I didn't fall to the ground, but I caught myself. I stumbled, and I wrenched something in my back. And I knew I was in pain, and I was down. And the following day, I was in the shower, and I was feeling okay, but I was still kind of tender. And I slipped in the shower and caught myself again and wrenched myself. And, this is going to be the last day I'm going to do this. And I woke up Wednesday morning, and I was just killing. So I went to the doctor yesterday and got some medication and some treatment for my back.
I hope they were opioids.
No.
Well, a muscle relaxer with the scotch and soda is a good, that's my prescription.
Yeah, I know. And muscle on some super aspirin too. But it didn't stop there, John, because
geez. More cat stories?
No, so on top everything off, one of the cats had like scratched me. I was roughing around with the cat on my hand, and it also got infected. So yesterday I was at the hospital for an infected cat scratch and a cat-induced back injury,
and a cat destroyed right. Laptop.
Right, exactly.
Which cat is this, by the way? He has two cats. Do you have two?
I have three cats.
Oh, Jesus. I feel like Morty and Rick and Morty. Jeez.
Jeez. Yes, we have three cats. We have the wonderful Ilsa Penelope cat, who is a Balinese mix, who is fantastic.
But I'm sure.
We also have a dwarf cat named Tyrion the Half-Cat.
Right, because his legs are about as big as like a tiny little pencil stub that you have, right?
Exactly.
Something like that. It's like three inches long.
Yeah, his legs are only about 3 inches long. But he's a fan of John's. And then we took in a friend of my aunt's cat after she passed away named Grady, who I think is the suspect for peeing because he's a big cat, so he can get anywhere. And it wasn't a place where the other cats could really easily get to it. And the cat that made me trip was Ilsa. So it's kind of a twofer there. And then the cat I was playing with was Ty. So they all kind of have it out for me.
Apparently. No, you know, Jeff, this whole cat fixation that you have is rather terrifying. I mean, in a way, I'm listening to you talk about your cats. Like, you've given me the little hints of their personalities and their names and so forth. The main thing is they will sit by your bed when you're asleep and suck out your immortal soul. That's what they do. I would get rid of them. I would not. I'd rather have, you know, a capuchin monkey and a mina bird rather than cats, for God's sake.
Yep, well, there's my cat story, as promised, and John.
Yeah, but so all of you who are emailing and texting and, I mean, Facebooking, saying, where's the podcast? Like, people say, I'm having a guy named Bill, like, where's the podcast? And I didn't know what to say, because if I had written that, the cat peed on Jeff's computer, no one would have believed me. And I still don't believe Jeff, but I'll let him get away with his story.
Well, I think the laptop's still at work if you want to smell it. It smells terrible.
No, thank you. I'd rather not. God, I hate cats so much. And I, you know, you're a sane person, but I'm wondering if you're like, as you age, are you going to be like those cat ladies that hate my guts and tweet me pictures of their cats? And
no,
because it's that thing, you know, it's the bacteria in the cat feces that gets into your brain and it drives you mad, which is why crazy cat ladies are crazy, because that.
Well, I believe it predominantly affects women, so I don't think.
Oh, there you go. Poor Christine. Okay. That's the cat story from Jeff. Now, I got to ask you before the guest, we get our guest on, Carol Markowitz from New York Post. Are you ever worried about being canceled?
Yeah, I'm not. I go out of my way to not engage in anything that I think would get canceled, but, you know, they come for you when they come for you. I try to keep. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think about it, but I can see everybody. But I, you know, I'm on the other side of media, where I'm in media, but I'm also, you know, consuming a lot of media and a lot of, you know, writings and reporting and stuff. So I see people and their opinions on things and the way they, you know, what they really feel. And I certainly see things where I think, uh-oh, they're going to come for them. Like, yeah, if you have, it's take the people in Chicago or in Illinois trying to sue the governor to get churches open, or sue the governor to get themselves, you know, end the shutdown stuff. I mean, as soon as you saw that stuff, you knew the people were going to start a campaign to ruin their lives because they think differently or they dare have an idea that isn't in line with mainstream.
Well, I don't know what mainstream is. What was mainstream once was being able to talk about ideas, yes, have friends who are different than you, date girls and boys who don't have your politics. I mean, I actually married someone who was a liberal, okay? I mean, that was like, now you can't see that happening. You cannot see that happening. What I really worry about, not so much is getting canceled myself, but people who like, I talked to a couple of young guys, they're in their 20s now, and I said, and we're just talking about social media, and they said they would not like on social media something that they believe in, because it'll cause them to be canceled. And I think this is what's happened to the young. They tear the statues down. They wipe out history. This week is the birthday of George Orwell. They destroy history, and they right in front of you, and they tell you to shut up. And if you say anything about it, you'll be canceled. So we'll talk after Jeff finds a little musical interlude with Carol Markowitz, columnist of the New York Post, on the cancel culture and the cancel crew that will come for you someday soon.
One, two, three.
Three little cats went out one day over the hills and far away. Mama cat said, meow, 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 meow. Three little cats came running back.
The first thing they do is tear down the history right in front of your face and tell you, shut up and take it. The second thing they do is, if you dare comment or complain, they'll cancel you. This is a headline from a column in the New York Post. You can read her every day, every Monday, and I want you to start clicking on her stuff. Carol Markowitz, New York Post. The cancel crew will come for you someday soon. Welcome to the Chicago Way, Carol Markowitz.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you begin your piece by talking about the moral panic sweeping the nation. How do people react to the pitchfork hordes
that'll
determine the fate of our country? In your excellent piece, brave piece, you talk about there are people like, you know, Ben Shapiro and Tom Cotton, the senator, who was involved in that ridiculous Orwellian New York Times business where they canceled him out and fired the editor who dared run his opinion piece. And I call that the, I say that the New York Times, all the newspeak that's fit to print from then on. But what really struck me about your fine column is that you didn't just deal with the people with high profiles. Right. You talked about what happens to the average person who's listening, that who might want to press a like button and like something that she read or he read or forward it to someone else, and that the cancel culture is designed to intimidate and humiliate them.
Right. Well, I've been writing about kind of cancel culture for a while, and I think a lot of us have seen it coming. But one thing I had always sort of thought was the it's mostly a left-on-left phenomenon, the cancel thing, and conservatives were largely outside of it. And the example I always kind of use is Ben Shapiro, because he's a kind of a big personality on the right, and the left comes for him frequently. And every time they do, he sort of shakes it off and says, I'm not apologizing, and no, I'm not canceled. Then I will continue with my show and with my life, and that's it. But what's happening now is they're going to come for the audiences. And we've seen it already with Mike Gundy having to apologize for wearing an OAN shirt. OAN is a small conservative television station. The fact that he was wearing that shirt did not mean anything. It did not mean that he agreed with any of their opinions, and nobody could even articulate what the offending opinion was. So what we're seeing is it's not just the opinion makers, it's the opinion consumers. And that's a real problem, that if you like or enjoy hearing alternate opinions from the left, you're going to get canceled. And it means you might get fired and you could get shunned and all the rest of it.
Well, you meant to say, I think, that if you like alternate opinions from the right or center right, you'll get canceled.
Well, I mean, alternate opinions from the left, like as opposed, not leftist opinions, but anything other than left opinions.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So you break doctrine and therefore you're a heretic.
Right. Right.
One of the things I think people haven't really understood about the cancel culture and the statue, the ridiculous statue nonsense, is that they topple idols, right? That's what it's really about, toppling idols. And therefore, it's religious.
Yeah.
And those who don't topple the idols are heretics.
Right.
I mean, it's quite terrifying. And for young people, Carol, and I'm sure you know some, I know a couple, that they might be afraid to like something. Like on social media. What does that do to our culture when people are afraid to like something?
Well, I really do think it leads to more conspiracy theories and more extreme opinions, because if you're told that mainstream sort of conservative opinion is not okay, you might seek out even more extreme, more unacceptable opinions. And I really see a lot of conspiracy theories sort of rising up right now, just because people are told what not to listen to. And so they follow that to the natural conclusion and seek out even more opinions that they might not be allowed to hear. You know, since my column ran, there's been several other cancellations since then. British Columbian in Canada, board member of a university, had liked on Twitter, not even retweeted, Dinesh D'Souza's tweets, and was let go for that. So, I mean, we're seeing this on such a grand level and for such minor infractions. You know, how dare you like a tweet of somebody I don't like? It's going to continue to spread. And like, as I say in the column, it's going to be up to regular people to stand up for it. Corporations turn out, you know, not to have any backbone whatsoever. And companies generally don't stand up for their employees. But it's going to take kind of smaller businesses and individuals to say, no, I'm not canceled. No, I'm not firing my employee over this. I'm standing behind this person. And no, you're not coming to them.
I think that applies to editors, too, of major metropolitan newspapers.
Well, let's hope. Well, that's really the thing, is that for so long, I think it's been only happening among the commentator set. And the spread is really what's worrying to me. But, of course, the idea that Tom Cotton's piece, you know, he's an American politician elected by the people, as if his opinions are so far out, and they really weren't either. He represented a majority of opinion at the time where Americans were watching these riots and wondering when they were going to stop and how they were going to stop. And him saying that we should send in the military was completely not a crazy thing to say at the time. And it's just that they couldn't come for him and they couldn't get rid of him. They got rid of everyone around him, you know.
They got rid of the editor who published the piece.
Right.
They became, they basically capitulated. The New York Times had been the standard of journalism in America, even though I disagreed with their editorial board. They did some fine work. Of course, they also are responsible for a lot of this because they published and supported that ridiculous 1619 project, which many historians have condemned as reputable historians have condemned as not factual and just a political cant.
Right.
But it does give, you know, New York, the school systems are using it. I don't know. In Chicago, I believe they're using it. I don't know what they're doing in New York. Is de Blasio using it?
I'm sure we will at some point. I have a child in fourth grade and first and in kindergarten, or going into kindergarten, and I haven't seen it yet, but I absolutely expect to.
So your other point, that when people are denied the opportunity to engage on ideas in the public square, it tends to drive them in underground.
Right.
Where they're more susceptible to extreme positions.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And that's what worries me, because
that's what worries me.
Yeah, what worries me is that young people, particularly men, particularly young white men who are, the victim, in a sense, you could say they're the victims because they're the ones who are bearing the responsibility for the racist sins of the past, although even though we elected a black president two times, you know. And I worry about them because they get driven into corners that they can't come out of.
Right.
And violence happens as a result. Is that what the left really wants?
I mean, I think that they're not thinking it through, but the idea that you keep telling people how they're responsible for all of society's ills, and that they won't fight back against that is just naive, and it can only go on for so long.
Tell us a little about yourself. How long have you been writing a column for the New York Post?
I've been there about 8 years, and my beat is sort of culture or what people are talking about. I don't write about straight politics that often, although that's my background. I used to do campaigns and public relations for political campaigns and candidates and that kind of thing. But yeah, I've been at the Post for about 8 years, and I also write at the Washington Examiner and the Spectator US magazine.
So you're trying to make a living in the public prints.
Trying.
And it's... And it's difficult, particularly in the as the model of standard journalism breaks down.
Right.
And I've noticed what I have noticed in the 3,000 years that I've been at the Chicago Tribune is that we had real straight news, and we had opinionators or columnists. And what happened is, and I was part of it. They wanted the narrative, the news narrative, to be a little bit more interpretive and edgy.
Right.
And as we did that, you know, you can do that on political stories if you're smart, and if you're not just didactic about it. But what happened is that I think the trend overwhelmed the system, and now that the print is dying, the electronic side of it appeals to, you know, to each individual tribe, and they're stuck appealing to the tribal political aspects of it, and not having any generalized, you know, take the three steps back and look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's this thinking now, you know, the year zero, the fact that they're tearing down these statues because, you know, history doesn't really exist for them. And it's not like the idea that somebody was an imperfect human, but still really a really spectacular figure in our history is impossible for these young people to understand. And the lack of history is a real issue there. The year zero thing that people talk about, that, you know, history begins right now, is just, it's unfortunate. And you could absolutely see that in the news side of the media, that the moral considerations are now outweighing whether something is a story, or whether a story should be told, or how it gets told. Example I use in the piece is the Washington Post essentially ruined this woman's life for a bad Halloween costume a few years ago. She came to a Halloween costume of a Washington Post cartoonist, and she was dressed, tongue in cheek, she was dressed as Megyn Kelly in blackface. And the Washington Post ran this whole article about her, a really long piece, and she was fired from her job. And she's not a public figure, and she's nobody you would have ever heard of. And she was deeply sorry for what she did. She was in therapy over it. And yet it was just a way to show the moral superiority. Like, we root out blackface and racism wherever it exists, even if it's not a relevant story to the moment.
Does that apply to the governor of Virginia?
Of course not.
Or to Jimmy Kimmel?
Right. Well, so one of the things, and I say this again in pieces that I write about this, but the way you react to it, the way you react to an attempted cancellation is a big part of it. And Jimmy Kimmel and the governor of Virginia both sort of shrugged it off and said, I'm not canceled, and, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm not stepping down, and that's it. So, if anything, we should take their example. And if more people react that way, then maybe this thing can wind down eventually.
You asked for, in your piece, you asked that people be brave.
Yeah.
But isn't the whole, and that individuals, readers, your readers, my readers, others listening to this podcast, that they should be brave. And when people are canceled, their friends are canceled, they have to show support.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But at the same time, we have a cadre, a whole population group of, let me just simplify this and overgeneralize, but I would say white suburban women with their hate have no home here signs in their front lawns. And they're terrified of, you know, they're terrified of the riots. I'm sorry, did I call them riots? Yes, there were riots, especially in Chicago when they were coming out to Oak Brook Mall, you know, and that would bother the people of Oak Brook and Hinsdale and so forth. They were terrified, and they were thinking about where do we get guns, and they wanted to learn, you know, how do I get on the scanner to listen to the police scanner. But then that kind of settled down, and now they have their hate hath no home here signs to protect them.
Right.
Will that protect them?
It won't. I live in a very liberal neighborhood in Brooklyn, and there's all these defund police signs everywhere. It's just funny because, yeah, it's easy to defund the police when you live in a really safe, crime-free neighborhood. When you don't want to defund the police. And as I've been saying about the recent crime spike in New York, if the crime spike was happening in white rich areas instead of black poor areas, the message wouldn't be defund the police, it'd be triple the police. We'd find the money for it, and it would be a police officer on every corner. So,
and the National Guard.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Suddenly, you know, Tom Cotton's philosophies would be everybody's philosophies. So I really do kind of blame the white left for these insane ideas that they could never really live by. And I see it all the time.
I see them. I wrote about it in a piece that I guess now I'd say last week, a piece about the French Revolution, that we need a new statue on the Mall. Mm-hmm. And it was of Marie Lamballe, the princess, who was a friend of Queen Marie Antoinette in the year zero. She was a revolutionary. She loved, for you know, the slogans, and she was enlightened,
right.
And she hosted the all the intellectuals at her salon, which is not a hair salon, everybody. Uh-huh. They don't do hair in the salon of the Renaissance of that time. And she herself then was tried, and she said, I love the revolution, but I love the queen.
Right.
And so they took her out and cut her head off.
Right.
And paraded her head on a spike. And I see this as the, you know, the hate has no home here signs, doesn't protect you if you're not woke enough.
Right. The guillotine will come for you anyway.
As you cover culture and art, one thing that concerns me on this, another aspect of it, of your fine column, and again, we're talking to Carol Markowitz of the New York Post. Her column can be found at least once a week on Mondays. So look her up on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle, Carol?
It's just my first name, at K-A-R-O-L.
At Carol, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how does this cancel culture apply to the arts? I've seen in Chicago, Jeff will confirm this, the head of Second City got groveled and got on his knees for, I guess, not doing enough
to
promote black artists. And then, of course, he was gone. The Poetry Foundation, you know, the leaders of the Poetry Foundation all had to quit, or they were threatened, and they were almost canceled, or they did. I don't even remember. The effect of it, I think, is we're going to have art that's not subversive in the sense that it's not iconoclastic, but it will be very doctrinaire and supportive of the left pushing an idea. It'll be propaganda. Do they even, I mean, has that even been considered yet?
I think that the art world is really in trouble, and in so many different ways. In New York, somebody made a list of all the theater companies that had not made a Black Lives Matter comment. And a lot of them were absolutely on the right side of that. They just hadn't made a comment. I mean, we're still in the middle of a pandemic for many reasons. I think people didn't speak out. And so, I mean, when they're coming for theater companies for not being expressive enough of whatever the cause of the day is, it's a real issue. And I think we're seeing that also in other ways too, where two white actresses yesterday quit their roles on a cartoon series because the cartoon characters were either Black or mixed race. And so they felt that Black actresses should play those roles. Of course,
cartoons?
Yeah. Well,
what,
yeah.
What cartoon show?
I don't watch the shows, but it was Kristen Bell, who plays, you know, Anna in the Frozen movies.
Right.
She played a mixed race character on some show, and another actress who played a Black character. And both of them said that they are quitting because they feel like Black actresses should have those roles, which is fine, except we have the biggest movie waiting of the season is Hamilton coming out next week. And in there, the whole entire cast is Black and brown. And that I loved Hamilton, the show. I mean, I thought this was a genius idea. I love the way they portrayed it. But if you're saying that white people can't play Black characters, are we really going to go down that road? Because ultimately, somebody will say, well, Black people can't play white characters either.
Yeah, who would say that?
Well, it will become a thing. I mean, absolutely. It's not going to always go one way. It's just it never lasts that way.
The larger question is, besides the fear of the poorly of the pseudo-intellectuals, is the establishment or the tamping down of metaphor by which a society and a culture understands itself. Mm-hmm. And that in art, if you restrict metaphor, then what are you doing to the minds of the people?
Yeah. It's a tough situation in every field again, but I really feel like the arts are going to be hardest hit by it. It's already a majority liberal, population. And again, this is a left on left phenomenon almost always. And so we're going to see them come after each other more often in the art world for sure.
Right. And then if you are the Marie Lombal and you think you are woke, but then somebody else says you're not. They just take your head or your career.
It's never enough. Never enough.
My gosh. So, what's next for Carol Marcos?
What are
you working on now?
On Thursdays, I think about my next column, so I'm still thinking it over. But I have a piece coming out on the coming apocalypse in our police departments in the Washington Examiner magazine, and about how they already were having recruiting problems before these riots, and now it'll be even more so. It'll be much harder to get good police officers to join the force, and it's really sad and scary.
The job of a police officer is to basically express the force of the state on those who don't want to obey. Right? And part of that it's not about guidance counseling. It's about dealing with somebody who's lost their mind, sitting in their mom's garage, high on cocaine and maybe in a paranoid, delusional state, naked, and you have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And people,
Send in social workers for stuff like that.
Right. People don't understand that. Also, what have you found out anything about Chicago? Because we're going through.
Of course, yeah.
Does your piece reflect on anything?
No, I mean, it covers the fact that people don't want to, or that you're having recruiting issues in Chicago as well. But we, in New York, we hear a lot about the problems that Chicago is having, and it's really scary.
I hope you'll come back on the Chicago way. It's a way to divert my brain from threading four a week.
And Thank you so much.
And I just can't wait for you to come back. And again, everyone, Carol Markowitz, New York Post, it's not the newspeak paper, it's the real paper of New York. Thanks for being here on the
Chicago. Thanks a lot. Thank you for having me.
For Carol Markowitz, columnist at the New York Post, New York's real city newspaper, not the all the newspeak that's fit to print paper that disgraced itself, but the New York Post. And you can find her on Twitter, as she said, at Carol. And for her column, "The Cancel Crew Will Come For You Someday Soon." A message to all you suburban moms with your "hate has no home here" sign. And you're wondering how you're going to protect your kids from the cancel culture. If you don't stand up and oppose it, you won't. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show on WGN, and owner of three cats, one of which is on my bad cat book. And the other one that hurt his back is in trouble with me. And I still like Tyrion the half cat, at least in the abstract. I just never want to be close to him because I'm allergic. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, a member of its editorial board. Hoping I'm not canceled yet, but of course, that's really up to you. If you subscribe, and subscribe to this podcast as well. Just find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, write us a kick-ass review on iTunes, and we'll love you forever. Thanks for being here on another edition of The Chicago Way on WGN+.